If you're feeling a little cabin feverish, take a little winter road trip to Ottawa, Illinois, a fun, friendly, charming destination with boutique shops, small-town coffee shops, award-winning locally brewed beer, and all kinds of excellent casual and fine dining. Log on to visitottawail.com today.
Today is Wednesday. It's January 15th, 2025. It is 2:38 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast, the podcast for people who care about Chicago. Listen for me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter and columnist, now doing the Chicago History website on Substack, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
I'm Brandon Coe from WCIU and contributor to a host of other platforms.
I'm Marge Halpern, a communications consultant with experience as a journalist, as a government reform worker, and activist in the community, doing what I can to challenge authority.
I'm Eric Zorin, publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, the weekly Substack newsletter that also cares about Chicago.
We have talked on this podcast before about things we would recommend at the end, something you were eating, drinking, listening to, watching, reading, whatever. I think it was Kate in the little exchange we had beforehand said, let's do something we don't recommend. Or
we're all in
on it. I think it was Eric. And I think I just contributed the idea of calling it red light, green light. Based on one of my favorite old children's games, where we could talk about things we both like and hate.
Well, that's funny, because if we do that, I'm going to put a red light on Squid Games, which is a play on that old game. The second season, I think, is stupid, but we'll talk about that. In fact, Brandon is on this podcast today because he wants to run down what later on?
Oh, Emilia Perez. I got to bash it. I have to. Okay. I have no choice.
And I think it's the best movie I've seen in a while, so that'll be fun.
Should be.
So let's start here. At what age should Illinois seniors be regularly tested for driver competency? Every year you need to prove that you're good enough behind the wheel, starting at age 79. Our Secretary of State, Alexis Janulius, and some state lawmakers want to raise it to 87. Secretary Janulius told us on WGN Radio today that a group of people say over the age of 74 have fewer accidents than any other age group. It doesn't make sense to discriminate against them by putting them through the stressful annual driver's test. Let's at least wait until they're 87. I don't agree with that, but I wonder what the gang thinks.
I think if you're older than the President of the United States, then you'd have to take a driver's test. I would like to see more data on this. I understand that when you look at the per mile driven, that older drivers tend to be safer. But then there's the question of, well, where are they driving? Are they driving back and forth to the grocery store, whereas people who have less good safety records are driving on narrow country roads at high speeds? I don't know. I don't know whether you can draw a definitive line like that. I would think, though, that somewhere in the 80s would be when you would want to ramp up the testing on drivers. As someone who's in his late 60s now, I feel like I'm pretty good at behind the wheel, and I can imagine being good for a while. But up in the 80s, yeah, that would be my. I'd draw the line there.
I feel like this is a more complex topic than the basic responses or proposals address. I have a very good friend who's a gerontologist. And some years ago, when a beloved aunt was driving a little erratically, we watched her back out of a driveway, bumping into cars in the mailbox on the way and waving happily and driving away, and thought somebody ought to test her driving. And my friend said that, contrary to what Alexis Janulius says, family members are the least accurate in evaluating whether their relatives can drive safely.
Wow.
Because if they can't, the burden is on you to then drive them around places. So he says family members, and he cited a study in a medical journal, which I could share with you if you're interested, that says the best evaluation is from a neurologist, and that the main issue is about dementia, where your memory short-term memory is not good. So you pass a bicyclist and then you forget the bicyclist is there and you turn right, right? So the issue is not so much age-driven, but mental acuity. And your doctor is the best person to make that evaluation. Hmm. That is the science that I accept behind this. So automatically testing somebody to give an age especially given the factors Eric just said. They're not driving maybe on the highway. Or I have an older sister who doesn't drive at night anymore because she thinks her vision is not as good or reliable. I have other friends who don't like to drive on the highway or, you know. So everybody set some limits for themselves, or their doctors will advise them that they don't have the capacity. And to set a blanket age, I think, is so arbitrary that I don't think it's even that effective.
I did like the idea that family members would now have a mechanism to alert the older person's driving ability to a medical professional. They'd have to get the state to then endorse them. And if the state, because a doctor doesn't think they're competent, if the state realizes that, the state will pull the license at the behest of the family members through a medical board or a doctor. And I thought, that's a pretty good idea, because plenty of us know when mom or dad, grandma or grandpa are bad drivers. But you're telling me that doesn't motivate us to turn them in because we don't want to be their Uber driver, right?
Right. Hmm. Right.
You know, I listened to your conversation, John, with Mr. Giannoulis. I just felt like you could drive a truck through every logical loophole. There were so many. And you pointed a lot out so many of them when you spoke to him. What I kept coming back to myself is thinking, like, okay, I don't know if everyone completely understands what the current rules are. It did used to be before the pandemic that you had to start testing, drive testing at 75. And they changed that for the pandemic. So right now, the deal is when you're 79 or 80, you have to take a driving test if your license expires. Then from age 81 to 86, you only have to go every 2 years. Then at 87, you start going every year. So that's the current rule. And I would submit that that is not in any way, shape, or form onerous. Thus, the onus should be on people who want to change that. So what's the trade-off here? The negative part of this trade-off is just trivial. You're asking people who say they are capable of driving to every 2 years spend one afternoon going to the Secretary of State to prove that. How is that a big deal compared to the number of people who might give up driving instead of doing that, and they should, or who will be found not safe to drive when they do so?
Yeah. But is there data, though? Is there data, Kate, John, Alexi, whatever you might be, that shows that that's the threshold? I mean, I was suggesting sort of early 80s, sort of somewhere in between 79 and 87, 79 being the current age, 87 being the proposed age, that maybe there's data there. But I wouldn't want to just say, well, I know some old people who are bad drivers, because you can make that same argument about young drivers. You say, hey, you get your
but
license.
You're not saying don't let them drive. You're just saying get them tested.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, people bring up the teenage thing all the time. And, you know, I would love it if we could not let people drive until they turn 25 and their prefrontal cortexes are fully developed, right? That's not going to happen. And it wouldn't make any difference, because you're not testing whether or not somebody, a teenager, will drive nice and carefully with an adult in a car. You cannot send them to the Secretary of State to test whether or not they're going to go partying and texting and trying to impress their friends while they drive. You can't find that out in a driver's test.
But right. You're going to be on their best behavior when they're doing that.
If somebody is impaired, even with an adult in the car paying attention to them, that you can. And that is what testing for elderly drivers would do. I know when my dad needed to stop driving and would have liked to have, because he had Alzheimer's, but my mom didn't want to do all the driving and felt that if she coached him, she could get him to drive. And I could not dissuade her of that for a long time. And then there was a horrible accident in Southern Illinois that we knew some of the people involved. A couple of teenagers were on a cycling trip. So they're out on a rural highway, and an elderly driver just, they were on the other side. He crossed the dividing line just out of nowhere and drove straight into them and killed them. Now, I'm not saying that happens to everybody, but it happens.
I'm confused why they chose the age of 87 as the kind of the threshold to such a it's a weird kind of number to choose, right? The data suggests, for the state data they have, that senior citizens, they have way lower crash rates. They're not getting in car accidents. It's really, I'm more concerned on the road when I'm on the road seeing people my age than I am seeing anybody older than me, right? So I'm a person who's a fan of everybody retaking a driver's test every 5 or 10 years.
It's, I mean, if it was 102, we'd say it can be lower than that. At some point, you got to land on a number, and they've picked 100, and they picked 87. But the point is, it ain't going to be 79 if he and the state have their way.
I think it's all pretty arbitrary, and I appreciate Kate's anecdote, but you don't regulate based on anecdotes. And we have some in our families, all of us, I'm sure, but there should be science behind this. The age should be chosen appropriately, and it should be based on the statistics. And what Brandon just mentioned suggests that it's not such a widespread thing. What is it going to cost the state to do these tests annually or by however often they do it on everybody of that age? Is that really an investment we should be making when the actual problems that cause accidents and deaths are drunk driving, text driving, other factors, way more than age, according to the statistics we've seen so far? It just seems like a, I don't know, arbitrary and wasteful to regulate based on presumption and perception. This is not about perception. It should be about science.
I think science does show that elderly people slowly lose not just cognition, but hearing and sight. So I don't think this is based purely on anecdote, but also the only data that's being cited is drivers over 75.
Yeah, right.
Have 25 accidents per 1,000 drivers, which is lower than any other age group. But as we know, what we should be talking about here is not over 75, but looking at it by age, not just this one vast age group.
It's very 75. Convenient they cut it off there
at
75.
That doesn't tell us anything.
Yeah, because then they say,
I think it's a medical
that
question.
That is not data-driven. It's already not data-driven, I think, is my point.
It should be medical. There should be better avenues for recommendations to come from medical.
But senior citizens vote.
But then you would be requiring people to have a medical exam and an actual written thing from their physician every year, which is
Medicare requires.
I want to bring up the other factor that senior citizens vote, and I think if you draw the line at 79, I don't know what the percentage is of people that are voting in their 80s, but that group would sure be very happy about that.
How could a Secretary of State have a higher political ambitions, John? you're so cynical. You're so cynical. No, well, Jim Edgar, George Ryan, all of them run for higher office, don't they? Yeah, I mean, I think that's got to be part of it. And as I remember your response from listeners, which is, you know, the WGN audience skews a little older, that they're enthusiastic about this.
And yeah, they are. They're mad at me.
Because you're the skeptic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like maybe splitting the difference. It's definitely clear. The science does show that reaction time slows down. Night vision particularly slows down. I know that my father stopped driving at night before he stopped driving at all. That was a smart decision. But he's the kind of person who was very aware and not particularly stubborn about things like that. But there are, you know, a lot of people who are stubborn, like Kate's mom, I guess, was. I mean, just or didn't want to drive. I think it does help to have the authority of the state to say, you know, well, you got to come in and take this test. And they go, hey, well, I might not pass it. That would be humiliating, or I can't be bothered, or maybe it is time to give up my license. I know that families don't necessarily like the idea of taking mom and dad's keys away, because that does put an extra burden.
Oh, my gosh. And it just kills their independence. But at the same time that he is championing this younger group of potential voters, he also tweeted out that it's really unfortunate that the city of Chicago hasn't been able to balance its budget in a reasonable way or generate sufficient revenues to make them a good enough risk. Our bond rating goes down, and the Secretary of State decided he needed to tweet about that. I don't know if that's common or his place, but he sure did, and then said, you know, I love the city of Chicago and we need good leadership. But he didn't say he's going to run for mayor in 2 years.
Raise his hand quite.
That was really funny part of your interview, John. And you kept pushing him on that. What he kept saying, I just have some ideas. That's all. I would share them with people if they called me. And you kept saying, well, what are those ideas?
He didn't want to tell us. So, well, do you have specific ideas? Yeah. So to tell us. And he's like, yeah, I don't want to. I don't know if he has anything to say. And I don't know that his phone is going to ring. But clearly he's telling us that he has better ideas than we're getting from City Hall right now. And
apparently Johnson isn't calling the current governor, so I don't know why he'd call somebody who wants to be.
He's not going to call the Secretary of State. You know, one other thing on that whole new thing that they're going to introduce, which is a great idea, allowing people to call anonymously to snitch on a close relative who they think is not capable of driving.
And that's it.
That is a great thing to add on. It doesn't mean that we have to change the other part of it, but that's a nice thing to add on. The only thing I would say, though, to that is it's not a cure-all. And then on the other side of the coin, if you've been asking your parent to stop driving and they won't do it, and then one day the state of Illinois calls up and says, well, we've decided you have to send medical information to our state board of medical review for us to decide if you can keep driving. You don't think mom and dad are going to turn around and point the finger at you? They're going to. There's going to be plenty of dissension in the family following that intervention from the state of Illinois.
Yeah, but chances are
nothing.
Chances are you're not the only one who noticed their bad driving.
Well, you know what?
You would have other
examples. If they don't know who did it, they're just going to be suspicious of their entire family.
I want to just real quickly go to the speed limit, 25 miles an hour. Brandon, what should the default speed limit be in Chicago? It's 30 now. The city council came this close to making it 25, and then they got cold feet. They now have a possible working group to study it. So that's the can getting kicked down the road. But what do you think the speed limit should be in the city, Brandon?
The speed limit should be staying at 30. I think bringing it down 5 is ridiculous. What you should be wanting to do in this city is enforce current traffic laws and enforce people that are having speeding violations, not creating a new threshold to punish people when they're not really speeding. Like, I would be pissed if I go 28 miles per hour in a place that used to be 30 and I get a ticket for it. That's wasting police time. That's wasting resources. It's also unnecessarily creating police interactions and driver interactions that you don't need to. So I just say focus more on enforcement. Get more people actually enforcing the current people that are speeding, which isn't happening. I know because I'm a person that likes to speed sometimes. You're not going to get pulled over unless you're like on the south side. So they got to do a better job of making sure that they enforce that.
You're not going to get pulled over, Brandon, but you're going to get a little ticket in the mail, depending on where you're speeding.
That's what I got.
Not going to work. Not yet. I don't drive that much, though. But
as another aggressive driver, I can tell you there is a map of where the red light and speeding cameras are, and I've got it always pulled up on my phone.
My dashboard tells
me. If I'm going to an unfamiliar part of the city, I check to see where those cameras are.
I get it.
And I know where they are in my area.
Speed warning coming up.
Yes,
speed warning
ahead. It's doing nothing to keep me from speeding in between. And I mean, of course, we all know if you go a little bit slower, you will kill fewer people if you have a crash. So I accept it's going to be fewer people at 25 than at 30. Twice as many people get killed in an interaction when people are in a crash at 30 than 25 is a number I've seen thrown out. That seems a little hard for me to believe, but I'm more than happy to accept it would be fewer people. But I keep coming back to the real problem is the people going 40, 50, 60, and that's not being dealt with. And I'm not hearing anything about how it would be dealt with. And I just have to say, Brandon, would you please run for mayor? Even though it might be hard having the same name.
We've already been burned with one Brandon. We don't need.
I would vote for you.
We don't need another Brandon. We've already been burned once. Eric, you've been a convert on this subject, though, right?
I converted from being an opponent to being a supporter of dropping the rules. But part of it was driving 25 on Western and Irving Park Road and some of the thoroughfares that I drive on. And I realized that's a fairly good speed when the traffic will allow it. I don't feel the need to go much faster than that. And the safety advantages have been proven over and over again in places where they've instituted this, in a lot of big cities, when they lower the speed limit, Seattle and New York and Sacramento, I think. I mean, there are a bunch of cities that have done this, and they've seen really positive results in terms of crashes and pedestrian injuries and so on. So I don't see the big problem. The Tribune editorial on Wednesday morning was talking about criminalizing people who are going 27 in a 25 zone. That doesn't happen. You get, I think, 5 or 6 miles an hour over the limit before a ticket kicks in. So if you're driving 34 in a 30 zone, you're not going to get a ticket, even if they take your picture. You've got to be going 30, 36, I think. And that seems reasonable to me. It also seems reasonable that they cut it down. I share the concern a lot of people have that this is just a cash grab, that although they say it's for safety, they're really just trying to write more tickets so they can get more money. And that's why I think studying this idea is good. Maybe doing some pilot projects on it would be okay, because I don't want it to turn into, you know, more and more fines for people who are actually driving safely. If you're driving 31 miles an hour on Western, that's safe. It's not reckless. When you're going 45, it's reckless, and those people should be punished and fined.
35 is safe. 35 is safe.
I said up to 35 is probably safe. But also, if you're going 30, you're fine, and you'll still be fine going 30, even though the speed limit will technically drop to 25. So I think it's a good idea. I think it'll enhance safety, and I don't think it's going to be that big an imposition, as long as we can really establish that it's not just a money grab.
I should probably never give you a ride anywhere, Eric. You'd be unhappy with me.
Scare the hell out of him.
Speaking of the cash grab, there were a couple of interesting statistics in a Tribune article back in the fall. It said, investigative magazine Mother Jones reports that Chicago issues more than 3 million tickets annually, far more than Los Angeles and New York City combined, generating 7% of the city's operating budget in 2016. And it also said, a ProPublica Illinois analysis from 2018 showed that traffic and vehicle compliance tickets prompt so many bankruptcies of Black Chicagoans that the court here leads the nation in Chapter 13 filings. And you put those two things together, it just makes me all the more skeptical of the need for this move.
So I think we need to pull back. I don't know what the scope of this working committee is, but I hope that it is more comprehensive than a speed limit analysis, because we've been doing traffic management as one-offs. We get money for speed cameras. Lori Lightfoot gets approval to reduce the buffer number of miles over that you'll be ticketed for. They decide to change the speed limit. They put in calming devices in some neighborhoods and not in others. This question of equity in traffic stops is serious, and the impact of these tickets, if they issue more on the south side, we need to know about that. There needs to be a comprehensive traffic management plan for the city, and I don't think we have one. How does changing the speed limit fit with how we use speed cameras, or how enforcement is used and how we devote officer time to speeding enforcement versus other things that they need to do? I don't see any comprehensive analysis. A mayor has an idea, whether it's to get more money or make things safer, we could debate that. But here's one idea. Should we do it? Yes, no. Oh, here's another idea. Should we do this one? Yes, no. This is not a way to manage traffic in a mm-hmm. city. And the one thing about the Tribune editorial that I did agree with, Eric, is the expense of changing all the speed limit signs. And we decided it didn't work out. We got to change it all back. I don't think we have money for that right now.
$2.5 million, they said.
Yeah. So let's enforce what we have. Let's look at how our traffic management system should be better coordinated, and then see what would improve things from there, if anything is needed.
You are so right, Marge. Now I want to vote for you if you're interested in running.
Brandon, you're out.
The whole point of doing it holistically, not only are they not doing it holistically now, they want to continue increasing that divergence. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, remember, Mayor Johnson wants to have more red light cameras only in the wards, though, where an alderman wants them.
Right.
The Rascals continue in just a minute, but give me a minute to say, if you're feeling a little cabin feverish, take a little winter road trip to Ottawa, Illinois. They're our sponsor. It's a fun, friendly, charming destination. Lots of boutique stores, small-town coffee shops, award-winning locally brewed beer, all kinds of excellent casual and fine dining. Settle down and snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms, hotels, private rentals, cottages, B&Bs. Start making memories in Ottawa, the middle of everywhere. Log on to visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. And now back to this week's edition of the Mincing Rascals. This will be our last podcast before the inauguration of the next president. And former First Lady Michelle Obama is not going to be there. I saw a story in Newsweek late last month, or December 16th, and at that time, 13 representatives said they would not attend the inauguration. 20 were still undecided, so maybe three dozen or more members of the House will not be there. And they are Democrats, including Sean Casten from Illinois and also Delia Ramirez, mm-hmm. who is a member of our congressional delegation, said she's not going to go. I don't know what to make about that. I suppose there's plenty of Republicans that didn't want to go to Barack Obama's inaugurations. I did see that the flags are going to be raised to full staff rather than the current half staff. When Jimmy Carter died, Joe Biden ordered that all flags across the country, federal flags, be flown at half staff. That's what we always do. Donald Trump didn't like the optics of that and asked them to be raised for his inauguration, and then they can be lowered again the next day. And that appears to be what's going to happen. Some Republican governors are endorsing that idea too. That is so trivial, but that's just where we are and where we're going to be. I'm surprised that I can still be surprised. That one shocked and dismayed me. Shocked might not be the right word, but I don't know what else to say. I was surprised at how petty and wrongheaded that was, and that everybody else seems to be going along.
Welcome back to the world of thin-skinned leadership, when everything has to be about Trump, even when it's not.
Jimmy Carter did not die to spite Donald Trump. I'm almost certain of it.
And yet, while on the day of his funeral, Trump had to complain about his Panama deal because he had to tear down his reputation, or try to tear it down. And the whole thing with the flag, no one said anything until Twitter, left-wing Twitter and social media, kind of razzed Trump about, ha-ha, now it's going to be half-staff on your inaugural, and Trump wouldn't have it. It got under his skin. It's so easy to needle him. And quickly, the GOP leadership bows down to his petty concerns.
Now, the flag thing is really, it sort of raises the level of pettiness again to the point where, you know, when the next, when this happens again, or when Trump dies, we decide, well, we're not going to, you know, a Democratic president can say, well, we're not going to lower the flags to half staff, or we're only going to do it for a week, or we're not even going to do it at all because screw that guy. And you just don't want that happening. As for Michelle Obama and some other people not showing up for the inauguration, I seem to remember a certain prominent Republican who didn't attend the last inauguration of President Biden. So I just think that when Trump himself raise the level of pettiness by not showing up at the inauguration, not exhibiting what is this wonderful or formerly wonderful part of American democracy, which is a peaceful transfer of power. But when he violated that in so many ways, I just can't even pay attention to the idea that Michelle Obama is not going to be.
But it's ironic, Eric, that the person who said when they go low, we go high is now not going to be part of the ceremony.
There comes a time where you can only go high so often. And then when the other people tend to just keep going low and don't meet you anywhere near close to high, you got to do what you got to do for your mental health. This is without knowing anything, really. We don't really know why Michelle Obama is not going. I'm hoping her health is okay. I'm hoping it's not something like that. But ultimately, I wouldn't blame her for just not feeling like going. I think she represents kind of the feeling of a lot of black women in this country who voted overwhelmingly for Kamala Harris, the first black woman vice president. It's a grueling time and grueling feeling they're having right now. They had to continually watch a black woman, qualified black woman, who had the second highest office in the land, be demeaned and called out her name in so many obscene ways by the people who are about to occupy the White House, calling her trash, calling her incompetent, calling her a DEI hire.
Questioning her blackness.
Questioning your blackness. Yeah, things like that. Things that just really just are beyond the pale. So I think Michelle Obama at this point, she expressed in her speech at the DNC, it's about character, it's about values, and she's just saying, hey, I'm sick. And that's the feeling that I hear from a lot of black women around the country and around the city. They are sick and mortified.
Brandon, do you think that...
I don't think they're the only ones, by the way, Brandon. You don't have to be black or a woman to share that feeling.
Let me ask you this, Brandon, Marge, the rest of you. Do you think that a person's presence there is almost an endorsement? I mean, history is going to look back at the Trump presidencies, I think, severely, and that you're all standing there welcoming him in says something. It may be your love of democracy, but maybe your love of democracy would call upon you to not be there as well. Her husband's going to be there. That is a statement unto itself, and it's more than just I don't like the guy.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think ultimately there is kind of that tradition, decorum, precedent, right? But I think ultimately what it comes down to, the onus is more on the president to do those things, right?
Yeah.
The first lady is not as much. And I'll recall Melania Trump did not attend the Joe Biden proceedings, did not go to the White House or anything. So, you know, I think the first ladies take a step back. It'd be more of a big deal, I think, if Barack Obama were to say, hey, I'm going to sit this one out. That's kind of more of the, like, we got to do this because this is what we always do. I think first ladies are a little more exempt.
Mike Pence's wife did not stand at the Jimmy Carter funeral when former President Trump and Melania were there. She with her body, sure sent a signal or a message, didn't she?
A funeral. That was wild.
Why do you say that?
Just all the interactions. It was just something it's jarring to see, but also comical in some ways. You had some moments that were pretty humorous, trying to speculate who's saying what and what's happening in the moment. Kamala Harris looking back at Trump and Obama cackling, and, you know, the interaction between Pence and Trump, probably their first time seeing each other since his supporters argued to hang him. Like, there's just so many things happening in that moment that were just fascinating and sometimes comical.
I love the George Bush tap on the Barack Obama chest when he walked by. It's just like, hey, bub, what's going on?
Well, I was just going to say that Mother Pence probably was pretty upset that Trump had approved the threats to kill her husband. That, you know, maybe she carries a grudge on that. And it does remind you that you know, the incivility of our politics these days, it just seems like it's ramped up again, let's just say. But I really like the idea that Bush and Obama, that when you get those old presidents get together, Carter, that they can set aside their differences, because I don't think they ever peeled the hide off each other quite the way Trump has peeled the hide off his opponents, and his opponents have peeled the hide off him. I don't see how you socialize or how you even pretend to be gracious and kind in a situation like that. I wouldn't want to be anywhere near someone who said the things about me that Trump said about Harris, for instance, or about Obama. I mean, how can you sit there and just pretend like, oh, this is just business?
Well, that's it. So it's almost disingenuous, this sort of civil chat that it looked like Barack Obama and Donald Trump were having. I don't think they were having any sort of a chat anyway. I think Trump was borrowing the moment to make it look like he was being civil. He was talking. Barack Obama looked like one-word responses and didn't exchange eye contact or smiles. And I think he knew full well that was part of the theater of it all.
You know, have you ever... You know, when you're in executive leadership, sometimes you have to interact with people you don't get along with, right? Have you ever seen a situation where people are smiling, they look very pleasant, but in reality, they're just totally ripping into each other? I see it. I've done it before because you have to maintain appearance.
He's doing it right now.
Well, I was at an event last year and Rod Blagojevich came up to me and I was really surprised and I thought, oh, man. And I engaged him civilly. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, no, this is your golden opportunity. You need to tell Rod Blagojevich how you feel about him selling out the Senate seat and selling out the state. But then I thought, what purpose is that going to serve? He's out of jail. I don't know. I just chatted with him, and I may have smiled and chuckled a little bit. I felt like a phony when I was doing it, Brandon, but I wasn't going to kick the guy in the shin at the time, although I do that on the radio, you know?
But you could have done that with the smile and the grin. and the observers would be like, oh, look at them. Good old pal.
Yeah, meanwhile, right.
Everything you really feel, you know?
So what about...
Now we know. Good, we've been warned about how disingenuous you can be. Is that what you're telling
us? Like Eric said, he's smiling now. So, so we have these hearings now going on for Donald Trump's nominees for Attorney General, Secretary of Defense. Pete Hegseth was up there. Our Senator Tammy Duckworth really gave it to him. But the opening statements from both sides made it quite clear that this wasn't really a vetting of a candidate. It was just a chance to say why you like him and why you don't. I guess we should go through this song and dance, but it's starting to feel like some other pro forma things we have in Washington, D.C., the State of the Union address or whatever. It's like we do this, but it's theater. And particularly in this case, where these are high profile positions that could be granted or denied, it doesn't seem like there's really much decision-making going on. When Hegseth was starting to try and give an answer to a question that a Democrat senator put, and they didn't like his answer, they didn't let him finish. They would cut him off, and maybe that's his own fault because, in fact, he wasn't going to answer the question with a yes or no, but it felt very predetermined.
You know, it's one more piece of the democratic process that Trump is tearing down. I heard a commentator on the radio say, on NPR, say that it used to be that the Senate would lean toward approving the choice of the president to let the president get their cabinet. But it also used to be that the president would lean toward choosing those who could be palatable to a bipartisan Senate. There was a give and take that happened there to get us the best people under either a Democratic or Republican ideology, but still meeting some bipartisan approval. Trump has thrown that out the window in a way to challenge. I saw Jennifer Rubin's written a column that says, this is the new DEI hire. This is the Trump definition. We're going to get white males, preferably with sexual harassment background like the president's, to further diminish the impact of his convictions or other things. And people who are more spokesperson than manager. He's picked a profile of people that are not the best qualified. Republicans know that. I mean, we're going to have an attorney general in Pam Bondi who is an election denier. How does that happen? She thinks the 2020 was stolen. She says that.
She didn't say Trump. That. She did not say that today.
She may not say that today, but she's on record as having said that in the past. So, you know, he's choosing the most challenging people possible. And I think I mentioned earlier on the show that I heard a former communications guy from his first term say that a problem that frustrated Trump was that the cabinet he chose was not a good marketing cabinet. That is, they weren't good at telling the agenda of the president. Hegseth was very good at that. He was all sound bites and he was all bowing down to the president and the leader. I want to do whatever the president wants me to do. These are people who are going to voice his agenda. Are they people who could run the departments, who could do the job? Clearly, Hegseth is not. That was clear from his, he doesn't have any experience in foreign
negotiations. Right, but when Hegseth said, okay, so in the past we've gotten generals or administrators or academics who fit the mold, and then he said, how's that worked out for us? We need for an unconventional president an unconventional cabinet. And so these people fit. So that's the new mold, Marge. I don't know how good a executive he's going to be. I don't know how much impact he'll have on our warriors, as they like to call them now. But at least it's in concert with the kind of president that the people elected.
Then he's going to have a cabinet unqualified. And if they fail, then the GOP will own it.
He also said many times, I don't know if you guys picked up on this, when they brought up the blemishes on his resume, he kept saying those were anonymous smears. And I thought, well, Oh, absolutely, they are. They are anonymous.
Some are? Well, a lot of them are not.
We know the names of the people who are saying that he sexually assaulted them or that he was carried up drunk. My point was this, that they're anonymous, maybe, and they're smears, they're blemishes on his character, but that doesn't make them not true. I wondered if he wasn't being a little Clinton-esque in his response when they would bring these things up and he would say, anonymous smear. Anonymous smear. And I thought, yeah, but he hasn't said that that didn't happen.
The one that's anonymous is the sexual assault because she feels threatened if she comes forward, and legitimately so, because look at the doxing that happens on social media. But the Fox employees, there are many people on the record about his drunken behavior and sexual harassment behavior.
I think she's also bound by a non-disclosure agreement, right? Because he paid money to settle with her.
Right. And then he says I was totally exonerated. He was not exonerated. It was dropped because of the settlement.
I didn't watch a whole lot of this because I just feel like it didn't matter. It just didn't matter what they were going to uncover, what like accusations they were going to make. I saw some clips, of course, of the Democratic senator just peeling the hide off of Hegseth with great questions, great comments. They got him dead to rights, but it just doesn't matter. This party belongs 100% to Donald Trump. They're going to confirm. I'm now thinking they're going to confirm every. If they're going to confirm Hegseth, they're going to confirm RFK Jr. They're going to confirm Tulsi Gabbard. They're going to confirm Kash Patel. They're going to confirm all the nut jobs that he wants to put into his cabinet because that's where the Republican Party is. Well, you can watch it and get all spun up about it, but it just doesn't make any difference. They could have photos of Pete Hegseth drunk off his ass with a prostitute in bed or whatever, and it wouldn't matter. It's the old, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and I wouldn't lose any votes. It's another version of that. That I think we're realizing that that's actually true.
One thing that lit up our phones this week on WGN Radio, I shouldn't put it that way, was the L.A. fires. And not only who is at fault, if anyone, maybe no one, maybe this was going to be as catastrophic as it was, regardless of who the president, governor, mayor, or fire chief were. But the hot topic, is it wrong that some people can afford their own private firefighting crews? And I had no idea those existed. And I learned a lot about that in the last few days. What's the reaction from you all? Do you think that's okay? I mean, why wouldn't you defend your property? And if you've got more money, you get more privilege in America. You get better health care. You can have private security details. And you can have your own firefighters if you want.
I think the one core issue is that these people have so much money, they can live in a place that should never be inhabited by so many people. They have too much money in a lot of ways. And I don't know when we come to grips with climate refugees, which is what our country is about to face. We're going to face them in Florida. We're going to face them in New Orleans. We're already seeing them from New Orleans. They've moved to Austin for now, mostly, but or wherever. But, you know, we have places in the country that are over-inhabited, that are uninhabitable by so many people, and ultimately will be uninhabitable totally. Manhattan is at some risk too, right? So we're not addressing this in any way. I heard Senator Johnson of Wisconsin on the radio this morning talking about this ridiculous idea that climate change is somehow man-made. We can't affect climate. Climate has been changing for centuries and eons. Why would man have any input on that? You know, so if we're still having that debate, you know, we're not facing the real problems that we have in this country that are climate driven and that are, the science is clear, man-made driven. And so maybe these people have the money to protect their house. Maybe they have the money for firefighters. But is this rebuilding these communities the right thing to do? I have a friend in L.A., a relative, who, when I saw the overhead photo of his house is still standing in the middle of a community that is decimated. Somehow his house and a handful of others were skipped over. And when you look at the aerial map, he has his house. But what does he have? His community is gone.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. It's a weird place to live now, isn't it?
All our hearts obviously go out to all the victims there. When the time comes, as it will, in looking over this entire tragedy, it will be right, I think, as you pointed out, Marge, to be considering how much of it should be rebuilt. What I've been reading is all the experts saying that in this case, climate change isn't even the driving force here. This is an area that simply always has these cycles, always has, always will. The Santa Ana winds are not even driven by climate change. They would be there anyway. You know, we do have to have that conversation, painful as it may be, about how much do you rebuild in a place that really should never have been built to begin with. In retrospect, if these people are going to be building homes in places that are so dangerous that they can't even get State Farm to keep insuring them there, then, you know, perhaps they should, in fact, be shouldering some of the cost of protecting their homes.
Didn't we face some of these rebuilding questions with New Orleans?
Yes. Like, oh, absolutely.
Over Ninth Ward. And I wrote a column back then saying, look, maybe it's time for us to accept that there are parts of this country where people shouldn't be living, that the chances for natural disasters are too high, and insurers are the ones who are going to ultimately enforce that, I think, Kate. It's like, if you have the thing is that these people whose houses have been burned down, they own the land, and the land is worth, or was worth, a lot of money. And so you say, well, you can no longer build there because of the risk of fires is never going to go away. I don't know that you can do that, but I think that it is incumbent on states like California to make sure that insurance companies are charging the actuarially determined price for insuring homes in that area.
But they can't do that in California. They capped it at 7%.
I know
that is the exact problem, that California said, no, you can't raise the rates to what they have to be. And then when you can't get regular insurance, you can get a state of California insurance. They basically make it affordable for people to have insurance where it shouldn't be affordable. So you are cutting the cord between reality and cost.
It is a lovely place to live. I mean, you look at that and you can see why people,
beautiful.
Rolling hills, you got the ocean there, you get a breeze, you get good views. It made me think a little bit about Lakeshore Drive and up and down the city of Chicago. We don't have a bunch of private structures along. People's houses don't line the lakefront in Chicago. We've made it kind of parkway, and maybe that would be the use of that. Too bad for the people that paid $8 million for the acre of land they have there, but I'm hearing what you guys say.
Maybe there could be like a quick take. There is a way to take that land, and maybe under the premise John just described, I wouldn't rule it out. The same problem that Kate is describing about insurance is happening in Florida. I think they have a similar state solution because they can't get flood insurance down there. I want to just put one thing on the record, because we're talking about these mansions and this very expensive property, but the fires have also decimated Altadena, which is a lower income, primarily Black community. I don't know if the solution is different, but the means are different. And so we should not put the whole brush over the whole area. They're not all wealthy mansions that were destroyed.
Mm-hmm. We have to be realistic.
I'm sure the new cabinet that is about to be approved by the Senate will be lined up to address this very issue effectively.
I'm not even going to entertain that, Marge, but what the hell are you talking about there? What would the new cabinet have to do with that? Nothing.
Well,
right?
There's an interior secretary. They're going to be in control of the discussion over climate and the impact of climate. They're going to talk about taking money away from FEMA because they claim FEMA's failed in places that they have not failed. You know, the whole argument about North Carolina and the hurricane impact there during the election, when the Republicans pretended FEMA was doing nothing, they were in fact very effective. So they're going to control the purse strings for all the things. And right now they're talking about withholding aid from California and tying it to raising the debt ceiling, which Trump needs if he is going to continue his tax cuts and these deportation camps and all the things that are going to make the deficit, current deficit, look like a bargain.
Well, such a bad idea, you know, because if you want to start holding states hostage when they're hit by disasters, look at Florida, look at Louisiana.
Won't do it to red states, Eric.
They won't. But
they did it to California before.
If the Democrats are going to play tit for tat, which I would think they need to threaten to do, that's really unconscionable.
I'm telling you, you're not going to get through 4 years if every time they are saying something, they're not doing something. And it's the the doing or this sort of measured anticipation of what they're going to do that we're all going to need to calculate. Because just as easy it is to go, wait, we're going to buy Greenland? What? Maybe we won't, and it's not worth the exercise. So this may fall into that category. But did you see that a state lawmaker in Indiana is introducing legislation to adopt 30 or so counties in Illinois and make them part of their state? Since 30 or so counties in southern Illinois have said we want to secede, if we let them go, economically, Illinois would be better off. And the people in Indiana who heard about this said, wait a minute, we can barely afford our poor counties. We don't need to adopt Illinois' poorest counties. That's a very red part of the state. And they understandably feel very disenfranchised from their own state in southern Illinois because all the decisions are made in seven counties that have very little in common with them. So I get the disconnect.
What a shame. I mean, honestly, be my guest, because at this rate, it's kind of like F around and find out, because they separate from Illinois. The economic impact they're going to feel, it's not going to be good in their favor. So, hey, if you think Indiana is better, that's a really big hearty chuckle there. And also, I got to add here, it flies in the face of none of those Indiana lawmakers or Illinois lawmakers could really say they're true fans of the Hoosiers or the Illini, because you're telling me you would unite, you would break that sacred rivalry because you're just mad at Chicago.
Oh wow! Makes no sense at all to me. Yeah, so you're putting this in terms of Big Ten sports and how disingenuous it would be. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're saying?
I put everything in terms of Big Ten sports.
What a unique spin. Eric, do you think anything like that would ever happen? I suppose it could. There is a measure, a way to do it.
Is there a way to do it? I hadn't looked into the proposal. It just looked like trolling to me. But if there's a legal way to do it, you probably would need consensus from both legislatures to do it. Yeah. I could see the Democrats in Illinois saying, yeah, go with God, go over to Indiana, and it'll solidify the Democratic control of Illinois, and it will let Indiana become deep red, although I don't know how populous these counties really are.
No, but they might pick up an electoral vote in the process, right? I wonder if that would also change your thinking about that. If their population was bigger, then they would have a higher percentage of the populace, and wouldn't they then pick up an electoral vote?
They'd pick up a member of Congress, maybe.
Well,
electoral votes is based on the members of Congress.
So they get both. Yeah, it'd be a package deal.
It would fix our finances, wouldn't it?
Well,
I think it would. Chicago puts in far more than it gets back.
Right.
Those counties get more than they put in. Our state and our city need more money. So it could be a resolution to our finances. And Indiana doesn't offer any services for much of anything. So it probably wouldn't cost them that much to add the counties because they just don't do a lot.
But it seems to me like it's like these proposals that people south of I-80 want to secede from Illinois and form their own state. And I think maybe it sounds good when you're having a little tantrum, but when you realize what the economy of a state like that would be, it would be as poor as the poorest states that we have. They have very little industry, very little in the way. I mean, they have farming resources.
It's sad down there. It's sad.
So this idea like, well, we're mad about Illinois and its laws, all of a sudden to turn around and go like, well, we're going to leave the state and make our own little nasty, poor little state. I think if they were actually to think about it a little bit more carefully, they'd realize that it's a really bad idea for them.
Rather than close the podcast today on things we're recommending, we're going to put a spin on it and deter you from things that we don't think you should waste your time on. Is that the upshot here, Eric? That's a kind of recommendation. Hey, don't do this. I've been there.
Before the podcast recorded, Kate expressed, I will give the floor to her in a second, some antipathy toward a currently very popular entertainment. And I thought, well, why don't we, every once in a while, we can turn it inside out and talk about things that we're not recommending. So I'm going to turn it over to Kate and let her go first.
Oh,
what do you not recommend? What do you not recommend? What's your hot take?
You're doxing me as a person who did not enjoy Wicked. I'm going to get in big trouble, especially because at least one of my daughters will listen to this. I love musicals. I do enjoy musicals. I expected to really, really enjoy it. I did not end up seeing it on Broadway or here, you know, the acting is amazing, and the sets and the costumes are all fantastic. But as a musical, there isn't a single song except Defying Gravity that I could possibly remember the tune to. And even Defying Gravity, to my mind, gets broken up with so much dialogue that you just, it gets rolling and then it stops. Then it gets rolling again and then it stops.
What about Popular?
You know, that's just me. I'm not the director.
Yeah, they did Popular. What about Popular? I want to be popular.
I don't know.
It's funny because I loved Wicked. I went in ready to hate Wicked, but I actually loved it. Speaking of musicals, the musical I thought was absolutely terrible was Emilia Perez. I think every year we get an Oscar bait type of film that people latch on to. And we look back on it, we're like, why do we give that Best Picture? Why do we even, you know, Green Book, Crash, Three Billboards, and Elbig, the list goes on. And I think Emilia Perez is this year's thing. I never left the movie thinking this is going to get award type. You got a musical with people that can't sing. You got terrible musical numbers. This is a choppy film. You could make us think about the lack of Mexican representation in a film about Mexico from a French director and stuff like that. But I just don't understand the hype it gets. The culture stuff, war stuff.
The LGBTQ community gets upset about that too, yeah.
I have nothing on the culture war stuff because it's not my culture. So I don't think I have a right to even have an opinion on that part. The movie itself did not sway me, did not move me. It made me cringe more than anything. And so I was surprised when John Williams said it's one of the best films he's ever seen. I'm aghast.
But front runner for best actress in a motion picture.
Zoe Saldana?
Yeah. Anything you want to steer us away from, Marge?
Nickel Boys. This was a read, a book club read. I think one of those that Eric says is required by law for book clubs. At least mine read it, and a group of us from the book club went. It's an amazing book. It is so well written. It's such an important story and written so well. Colson Whitehead's book is a must read. Most of his books, all of them probably are. I just haven't read them all yet. So we had high hopes for this movie. And comparing it to Emilia Perez is an interesting thing to do because similarly, the director gives in to a whole lot of creative filmmaking. But in this case, for me, unlike Emilia Perez, I feel that the filmmaking got in the way. The technique he starts with it carries through as a distraction while it's interesting and useful at the beginning. There's all kinds of clips, random shots of crocodiles. Where's that guy? What's happening? The line of sight, the perspective shifts from time to time. You're not always sure what's happening. I totally support the decision not to show the white-on-black violence and the cruelty that happened there. That is a fully understandable, smart thing to do. And some of the techniques he used as a director were effective, but ultimately they got in the way. And we left feeling that if you did not read the book, you wouldn't even quite know what had happened.
I saw the movie. I loved it. I haven't read the book, so maybe that's part of it too.
Maybe. You know?
I love the descent here. This is terrific. This segment is exceeding my expectations. I am not recommending Taffy Brodesser Ackner's new book, Long Island Compromise, which I read after I enjoyed that TV serialization of Fleshman is in Trouble, which is her 2019 debut novel that it starred Jesse Eisenberg and Claire Danes. New York Magazine said, the more time you spend with each character, the more delusional they seem to be. The Guardian said, they are essentially awful, sad people. I find the characters boring and not likable, which is not a problem necessarily. Unlikable characters can make for very interesting books. But if you want a sprawling family saga, you just can't beat Jonathan Franzen. And so I found this to be not worth your time.
Hmm. The one I would suggest you take a pass on if you're thinking about trying it out is the second season of Squid Game. Squid Games, I don't know if you guys followed the first season. I am intrigued by the game. I'm trying to figure out what the sense of this murderous game is, other than the fact that people that are in debt get a chance to win a lot of money and they'd risk their lives to get out of debt. it must be playing on a higher level and saying more than just that. But it even gets away from that and the game. And at the end, it's a ridiculous machine gun battle. And at the end of season two, they say that's only half of – they did to you on this what they're doing with Wicked. They say, okay, the next season will be part two of essentially this season. So you don't even come to any sort of logical conclusion. And I thought each episode got worse and worse and worse and worse. So I was disappointed with that.
Did you like the first season, John?
Enough to want to watch the second one.
I want to go back to last week and thank Marge for the recommendation of Jess Walter's book, Beautiful Ruins, which I've started and am liking it so far. I couldn't get it right away, so I got Jess Walter's other book, Financial Lives of Poets. Have you read that?
I just started it on your recommendation.
All right. Well, there you go. It's a book about a journalist who gets laid off, and it just goes from that to a lot worse. And it's he's a very nice writer, so I've enjoyed it. Thanks for that recommendation. So.
Yes.
Thanks you all for being part of the pod again. Nice to see Brandon on the Zoom screen here, and Kate, Marge, and Eric. Guys, well done. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another pod on you next week. Okay, kids, stay warm. It's going to get cold.
All right. Thanks. That was fun. That was a good
fun. I'm going to get in so much trouble from my kids. Because I was like, yeah, it was great, guys. I loved it.
I'll send you a different.
It's probably worth spending $30 to buy it.
Send a recut to
Kate. Yeah, I'll send you a different version.
Oh, my God. Wait a minute. Is that going to be in there, too?
Yeah, this is as well, yeah.
Kate had to sign out. She had some important business to do.
Like Brandon, I sometimes say things while I'm smiling.
I'm just jealous that your kids listen, man. I don't think my kids have ever listened to the Missing Rascal.
All right, campers, we'll put this up soon. See you next week.
See you. Thanks.
Bye.
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 Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.